Hello, hello, mamas, and welcome to another episode of Angel Moms Hopes of Heaven, brought to you by Alana Song. I am Angela Presley, your host for today. And before I introduce the person that I will be interviewing today, I'm just going to go ahead and get the sponsorship out of the way. Today, the podcast is brought to you by Alana Song. Alana Song Store has Angel Mom merch on the store. If you know an Angel Mom, if you are an Angel Mom, go ahead and jump on www.alanasongstore and grab some Angel Mom merch. All right, now that we have that out of the way, today I have a guest, Gretchen. I've been looking forward to interviewing her all this week. I've been on her page just checking out everything that she's doing with the community and what she's fighting for. And I've just been so excited to get her on the show. So, Gretchen, welcome, welcome to Angel Moms Hopes of Heaven.
Thank you so much,
Yeah.
Angela. It's nice to be with you today.
Yeah. So, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you okay. Would you like me to share how I got started in this
Yes.
journey?
Yes.
Okay.
Go ahead.
All right. Well, in my life, I've had many roles. I always wanted to be a dancer. I became a professional dancer, dance teacher. I was a fashion editor. I'm a fashion show producer. But of all of these fulfilling roles, the most important role, which I know you re can relate to, is that of mom. And I have two beautiful sons, and both of them now are, one's in his 40s, one's his fi early 50s, but they're always my babies, as we talked about earlier. And they both developed a real problem with addiction to heroin, in their teens, and so our family went through the struggle of addictive illness for decades, and that worry of losing a child. And also the sense that the society was mishandling it as a criminal justice issue rather than a public health issue. And so they were chastised and family shamed. And I just started speaking out because I needed to. I just felt like that it was my job, my role as parent, to advocate for the best care and the best understanding of this. And it was amazing when I started speaking out, it seemed to allow other parents to speak out and to stop putting this as a kind of a skeleton in the closet. Instead, discuss it and start advocating for a better understanding and better care, treatment, better response to addictive illness. So in 1999, I started A New Path, Parents for Addiction Treatment and Healing. There was three parents who co-founded the organization, and we were working to dispel shame and stigma, to reduce stigma, and advocating for therapeutic rather than punitive drug policies, treatment instead of incarceration. And in 2000, I was the state chair. I'm in California, Proposition 36, which mandates it passed and mandates treatment instead of incarceration. And since that time, my other co-founders felt like the job was done, but I felt like we were just beginning to scratch the surface of what needed to be done, misperceptions that had to be addressed, and laws and policies that needed to be changed. So I continued, and then it led to a whole host of legislative changes, really across the nation, because California tends to be the first one, and then it drifts through. And along the process, became a real advocate of harm reduction strategies as an answer, instead of criminal justice response, a harm reduction response, which is meeting the person where they are and helping them to fill in the gaps of what they need to be successful in life.
Wow. Wow. That's good stuff. That's because when you're fighting, when your child is fighting through addiction, I can't imagine. I didn't lose Alana this way. To watch your child go through this as a mother, to me, it seems you would be paralyzed. And like, what could I, you know, my kid is hurting and I don't know how to help. But you took a whole nother route and you were like, no, I'm fighting this thing.
I often tell people if my child had any other disorder, disease, or whatever, I would learn as much about it and advocate for the best handling of it, right? And so without the shame and stigma, that would be the response. But many parents were just sort of closing off. Doctors were even saying, do tough love. And by the way, I tried that, and I realized that for me, the if you wait for your child to hit their bottom, my child would be dead, and I wasn't willing to go that route. And so I started advocating against the tough love approach, against that whole concept of codependency enabling, which was never based on fact or science to begin with. It was an easy answer that doctors and society were giving people. And I know far too many parents who lost their child in the process and said, if only I had been there in those last days, or I had that memory. So I don't know why my sons survived. They both had really heavy doses of addictive illness. I mean, and our family struggled for decades with both of them. My second son didn't get sober until he was 40, didn't find his recovery till he was 40, after 19 different attempts at it, but he did survive, and now is working. Both of them work with me on this advocacy, and especially the true love, not tough love, is what we call it. I have parents who are told to have their teenagers sleep outside because they didn't belong in the house because they were too disruptive and things like that. So treating it as a behavioral issue that could be easily changed, when addiction has a lot stronger grasp than that. And when people are in the maze of their addictive illness, their sense of their self-esteem is so low anyway, that pounding more like your family's going to disinherit you and all that stuff just compounds the issue. And instead, I think that as a parent, you need to be there every step of the way and say, let's find another alternative. Let's here's a treatment program. Will that work for you? What do you know? You just being present and basically saying, I love you. I know you're in there. I know you're in there struggling to get out of this, and we're here. And especially my older son ended up being incarcerated because of possession of marijuana. Now that would be legal, what he was arrested for, but spent 11 years cycling in and out of jail, prison, and along the line, developing a pretty severe addictive illness. He first learned to shoot heroin behind bars. So the response of othering him and making him the bad kid and the criminal, basically criminal, at the age of 20, for what he put into his own body, it's a real life disrupted. And this is what we're fighting, that that people need supportive services. We have far too little treatment opportunities, far particularly in neighborhoods of poverty and color. The resources just aren't there. We're so far away from something that my goal would be treatment on demand. When the person's ready to get into treatment, they can get in. But we're far from that. You have to have the right insurance, and you have to, there's just not enough services. Meanwhile, the prison system industrial complex has builds up and builds up and say, hey, I got a place for you. And
Wow. I'm gonna unpack just a little bit. You said so much and it's so good. So good. We're going to rewind just a little bit for moms that are listening, and I'm sure the majority of moms have already lost their child to the battle. What if there's any signs that you saw that you could give to us to like, this is a red flag, don't block this out, pay attention to this. Help us, what you saw in your boys now that you look back.
Well, of course, I listened to the doctor. I was willing to do anything to save my son's. I'm talking about my first son now. I learned more by the time I realized that my second son was going through the same issues. But we used to spend a lot of time drug testing kids. Like, there's something must be wrong. Let's drug test them, whatever. And I basically came to believe that if you think your child is on drugs, just take it that maybe they are on drugs and they need help. So don't spend a whole lot of time being a detective and searching their room. And I was a person that would find needles in the room, throw them away. Now, today, I would say, let's take them to this syringe exchange, and because I've really embraced harm reduction. But it took me a while to get there. I didn't know people who were either had this in their family or were willing to speak about it until I started speaking about it. So it was a real learning experience for me too. And when we say harm reduction is about meeting the person where they are, it's also for the advocates, meeting them where they are and trying to illuminate more what the situation is. And I don't like to preach, okay, I did this, so you should do this. I think we What we encourage people to do, moms to do, is to take back your intrinsic right to nurture and protect your child. And your child means your child throughout their life, not at all ages, right? And we're all different, and every parent-child relationship is different. So I'm not saying do this or do that, but I'm saying believe in your core issue. If you believe you really love your child and want the best for them, then listen to your own gut and stop listening to some of the people who give you easy answers, who really haven't walked that road before and don't really understand. I'll share with you, I'm married now to a psychiatrist. He's not my father, the father of my sons, but he has daughters who have mental illness, and I have sons with addictive illness. And it took us years because he would think that I was being codependent because I was always there, worried at night when you get the phone call, is this going to be the police or the morgue and all that kind of stuff. But over years of watching and talking back and forth, he's come to really go back to the basic roots of, okay, a doctor's first, the Hippocratic oath, first do no harm, right? So it came to realize that loving them through this process and going back to the roots of that whole codependency idea. Of course, we're codependent in that we love our children for life, and we forever will want their life to be. We want to outlive our children. That's probably the most painful thing I could say to your audience, but I'm sure we all came from that place. So it's going back. And let me add, there is a fine line between helping and hurting. I won't deny that, but really going back to your core and saying, well, will this help or will this not? For example, I decided I was going to carry an insurance policy for my kids, no matter what. That's versus probably putting the money to a college education or whatever. But I knew what the reality was. And I knew that if they were ready for treatment, I wanted to be able to get them into treatment, right? Well, on those little moments when the door opens, right? And I also couldn't kick them to the curb when they showed up in the middle of the night, in the state of, drug use. But I would say, come on in, and in the morning, we'll lay out what your options are, and so here's this treatment, here's that. Will this work for you? That kind of thing. So I'm not saying that every parent should take in their child, especially if the child at the young person is being violent, aggressive, whatever. That's the parent's decision to make. But what I'd want to do is give them back the ownership of the decision making, because nobody can do this better than you know.
How I know you said the tough love, the this is what is pushed sometimes to go ahead with the tough love. How did you turn that switch off? I mean, there has to be just your human side is like enough is enough. I can't, I how did you say, I'm not gonna do tough love? It's going to be love, no matter what. I just the human side of a person will say, this is it. I can't.
And I remember conversations of saying, I don't take abuse from anyone, and I'm not going to take abuse from you either. But a lot of it had to do with understanding that they're not doing it to you. When they behave, when they steal from you, when they manipulate, and when they act out terribly, it's because to them, when they're in the maze of their addiction, the drug is like a god, and they don't believe that they can make it through another day without that drug. And if you are going to just, be there, then you're in the way, and they can act out. So releasing that it doesn't really have anything to do with me. They're not hurting me. Just pull yourself out of the equation and look at your child with love, and know that, I mean, and it was hard sometimes. My second son, it got really bad. I mean, I was afraid that he would die because of physical problems associated with IV drug use at the end, And now today, oh my God, he's the picture of recovery. He's healthy, happy, serves every day. I mean, he's a drug and alcohol counselor. So I mean, the ability for the body, soul, mind to heal is incredible. And I had to keep looking at this kid that looked like he needed to be exercised, exorcised, and say, oh, I believe that you're still in there and you're still struggling to get out. I mean, the real you, this really lovely man, is still there. So there's not a particular switch, but it was more of a belief. I did try tough love, and I kicked my son out, my first son in the 10th grade. I was going through a divorce, kicked him to his father, but that meant he had no supervision, and he just it went full blown into his problems, right? So I don't. So I realized, and we said this earlier, that for me, when you're talking about tough love, it's like if they put them in prison and that'll spin their head around and they'll get it. Well, no, they don't. Now they're labeled a felon, and they have much many more roadblocks in their lives. And so I didn't want to push the bottom, as they used to say, you lift the bottom up so they hit it faster. No, my kids, their bottom was death, prison or death, and I just would not go there. I just could not. And I didn't want to hear that they died, and they died without knowing that I was there loving them and still reaching out, right?
Definitely. Definitely. You spoke at the beginning of the introduction of as far as the resources. There's not enough help. Have you, from your journey starting this at the beginning and to the present day, have you seen? I know there's still a ways to go, but for you, there was the option of street and jail, street and jail. For moms out here now who feel hopeless, what's the avenue? I don't have insurance on them. I don't have the money for the, what's that in between streets and help out here? What's that growth that you've seen through the
Well,
years?
I've seen a lot of progress in terms of people's perceptions about substance use disorders, even the change of the name from calling somebody an addict to saying a person who struggles with substance use disorder, right? I mean, so we've seen some certainly some dispelling of stigma and using more compassionate, non-stigmatizing language. And we say that we've embraced harm reduction, which is a harm reduction could be anything from clean syringe exchange to Narcan distribution, which we do a huge amount of that in both locally and nationally. But it's also medication-assisted treatment, so we have to reduce the stigma associated with what path are you taking to your recovery, you know? All of that said, when it comes down to a parent calls me and says, I'm worried about my child. What can I do? And I say, well, do you have insurance? Do you have, there is frustratingly little options there. The good news is that the stigma has reduced, but and that there this opening up to harm reduction strategies. But the bad news is that on the ground, there is not treatment on demand. We are so far from it. And I've always said simplistically, well, if we just took the money away from the criminal justice system and put it into a better healthcare system, then maybe we would be able to have treatment that involves it, that has to be not one size fits all, because we are complicated beings and we all have different needs and different abilities and disabilities and whatever made up in all of us, right? And so for example, one of my sons could go to this treatment program, it wouldn't work at all for the other one, and he could go to this one and that works for him, you know. So finding having the person who's struggling have more agency about where they get help and how they get help, instead of right now, if you say you want to be on methadone, they'll say, oh, you're a loser. That's, you know, the only way to do it is abstinence-based. Now there's a better understanding that, hey, wait a minute, methadone has been around for years and it really has helped people to stay alive. You know, you can't recover unless you're alive, right? So it was a long-winded answer. I see the progress, but it's always like one step forward, two steps back, or two steps forward, one step back. It just, you know, you think, could we not learn from history? Could we not learn from all these tragic losses? I mean, right now there's a big push to make fentanyl Schedule One, and I mean, it's a revamping of the drug war. Well, it's that drug war is not a war on drugs, it's a war on people. And if you stamp out one drug, then another one comes in. For example, in San Diego County, you can't buy heroin on the street because now it's all fentanyl. And that's because they stamped out the heroin, the street heroin. So in comes another. Now, if we do the same thing with fentanyl, what other drug is around the corner? So we can't just keep making them Schedule One and making it a crime and putting people away from murder, like a couple uses together, and the guy dies, and the girl is charged with murder because she used with him and was maybe the dealer. I mean, that's so there's so many frustrating aspects to this, and because of the fentanyl crisis, I'm seeing a real slipping backward into drug war mentality and drug war strategy.
Because when I was growing up, it was the crack pandemic. And that was the answer. It was jail. There was no, they're addicts. There was no sympathy in who these are humans, and they have an addiction, a sickness. The answer was jail.
And that's so hard on the family. I mean, it traumatizes the whole family when you have a, one of our campaigns is the empty chair at the holiday table, and there are neighborhoods where, the father's missing because he was incarcerated because of a substance disorder, and that becomes a generational trauma, right?
It does. It does. It traumatizes, especially if you're going through this as a kid and you're seeing it take effect on the family. You know, the uncle or the dad or the brother in jail, that empty chair, you know, one of the empty chair syndromes, not necessarily death, just
Well,
not.
our campaign says that, during the holidays, who's missing, and to embrace and honor them, and set a place for them. But it's drug war damage, and it can be stigma. They're not there because the family's not inviting that person that's uncomfortable to be around. So it can be stigma. It can be a drug war violence. It can be incarceration, and unfortunately, too often it's overdose.
Definitely, definitely. For moms, how did you, as far as going into a facility or going to get help, how did you mediate with your sons? Because I know there was you know, we don't wanna, no, we don't, we're not going, you know. As a mom, what position did you take as far as, I don't know, the patience, the no, it's time, or you know, how could you not use the tough love in order for them to see it's treatment? It's, you know, how do you love them into treatment?
It's a sticky. You have to have a willing partner, the person being ready to go into treatment. I mean, I'll take the example of my younger son. He was in treatment 19 times, 19 times, and I was telling somebody, I think he was in treatment 15 or 16 times. He says, "You're not counting the times that you dropped me off and I went out the back door."
Whoa.
Right. So
Whoa.
very after struggling to get in there. I think the sense was they knew that they needed help, but they didn't believe that it could help, and they also could not believe that they could live a day without drugs. They could not believe that. And towards the end there, for my second son, he was looking at either the law catching up to him, so he's looking at either incarceration or death because of the health challenges associated with it. And I picked him up from a treatment facility he was just getting kicked out of, which I did many times in the past. And I said, "I know you're just going to make a run for it, either use till you die or run for the border or whatever." And I said, but he did. I For some reason, he got into the car. He just couldn't not get into the car. You couldn't do that to me. So when I said, "I'd like to take you to my office, and I won't bother you. I'm just going to set out the resource book that we have for all the treatment facilities, and you can just look at them, and I'll leave you alone for an hour, and then if you decide to go, I will have to say, okay, go." And he said that he walked through the house and he saw the pictures of the family on the wall and saw that he'd missed his nieces, and he'd missed all the family life and stuff. So he when I came back in, I expected, another bombastic kind of thing. And he said, "Okay, here's these three places. I used to deal drugs right down the corner here, so that's probably not a good place for me to go." He went through it like this. And then he chose this place in the boonies that was a Christian. He's not religious, but he said, "I think if We've tried recovery before, many times before. I don't really believe it, but if I have a fighting chance in hell to live, I need to try that one. And so, but by that time, he made the decision, because he made the decision to save his life. Now, the other times, I think that there, I mean, he had brief moments of, and that was the one that stuck, and it was really difficult. I mean, and the reason it worked, I think, is that his buy-in, his inability to just call friends and have them drop off drugs, because he was really good at doing that, you know, in treatment facilities. And he was there for 6 months. It wasn't a 1 month turnaround, and like oftentimes it is. So he even stayed a month longer than he had to in order to solidify it. And the other reason it worked is that he went then from there into sober living with outpatient, and then into, I mean, he took the steps to do it the way, so that a year later he was ready to move into society again, right? But the times before that, he would go and even get some sobriety afterwards, but relapse. It's a constant relapsing thing. But still, I believe, because I spent a lot of money, a lot of time and energy, any parent that's been through this knows. But I always looked at it like, he got a little, brief moment of sobriety. That means his brain got clicked in again, right? And he could think straight for a while. And he learned a tool from each one. It was like another tool in the toolbox when you're going to put your life back together, right? So I can't say this treatment's better than this one or that or anything like that. It's more like what tools did he gain that would later be useful in his life.
Oh, that's good. That's good stuff. And I didn't know, but I guess it would have to be, I didn't know that. Let me rewind. For you to become the advocate and for you to get this stuff going, you got an office, you're fighting for, you know, the cause. Did that push them away even more? Like, I definitely don't want anything to do with any of this.
And that's a really good point, because, you know, I always say, when in speaking out, is it their story and you're breaking their, you know, anonymity, or is it your story? But I've always said it's our story. So when I started advocating, my older son was, when I was a chairperson for Prop 36, my older son was in prison. And I went to him and I said, I need your permission. We're telling your story, our story. He always jokes about being the first poster child of a new path, right? Yeah. I even had a baby picture with bars saying this could happen to your child, you know, so he is the poster child. But he said, yes, you can tell my story. I don't think it'll help me, but I think if it helps anybody else, do it. Then my younger son was more reluctant. He didn't want his, you know, his addiction to be the
cast.
But then he opened up to it totally. And now both of them, because they believe so much in what I'm doing, they both are really good speakers. So they both speak out with me and talk the same mission, you know, as I do. And I think I'm so lucky, because I do know that parents who say, no, don't talk about me. You can't. And then you're sort of, you're a bit stuck, you know, then you'd have to be very careful about, certainly there were times that I didn't use their last name. There were times that now they're fully out, you know, but that one didn't want the picture. They didn't want me to use, younger son didn't want the picture. But now again, he's the first one to tell his story, you know, to anybody, the press included. So,
Wow. brave of them to you know, when you live that life, you're in the background. You don't want to be you want to be in the back, but so brave of them to say, but if it could help somebody else.
Well, and my older son, you know, it was putting him at a bit of risk in behind bars, because there was a whole lot of attention on this, and he could have gotten a lot of flack. And he said it was dangerous behind bars for a while there, with me being such an advocate and so anti, criminal justice, that it did put him in a bit of danger, you know. That he obviously survived, but
Wow. Yeah, I wouldn't even think of that. I mean, prison is a dangerous place, but you wouldn't even think of that, he's being put, he's being jeopardized for fighting for somebody to get healthy, you know, to not walk this path.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful. So I know there's always a, you know, walking on the eggshells, because they've relapsed so much.
Yeah.
How did you, when they were sober for a while, when did you feel like, okay, this is it, I can breathe?
When did I exhale?
How does a parent, is it always going to be like, a new day, he could tip over or relapse, or is there a let go? Is there ever a time a parent can say, I think we did it. I think, or is it like the alcohol, you're always an alcoholic, or you're always an addiction, you know?
Well, I think my younger son, I feel as good as any parent can about the futures of my children, right? At this point. But it took a long time. I would say that the real place where you can do that big exhale is when they're 2 years sober, because then they're not as in danger of that relapse syndrome. But the other thing is that, you know, as life goes on and things happen, my younger son broke his neck a year into his recovery, or a year and a half. He was surfing and he broke his neck, and of course had to be back on drugs, right? But he told them immediately, I can't do this, and if I have to bring in my counselor, bring in my mom, you know, to you have to know that I can't do these. So he advocated for himself. But there's always that worry that if they do have to medically be on, then that could just start the cycle again. Yeah. I think really watching him go through that and advocate for himself gave me a ton of confidence that mom doesn't have to fix anything. He's got it. And if he doesn't have it, he has his recovery support system.
Yeah.
Around him solidly, right? So, but you know, life is life. Anything can happen. You know, as a mom, you worry about your kids always, because as you know, anything can happen.
I do. I know this for sure. It's funny how you, when I hear an addiction, especially young, the first thing that comes to my mind is sports injury. I don't think of just teenagers out just doing drugs just because, but I have learned that anything can trigger the usage. Mm-hmm. So, is there any, if there's any advice you can give on like triggers, or I just don't, I just want to be able to give, these moms eye openers.
Yeah.
I haven't walked your walk, so.
Yeah, I think it's being mindful. It's very easy for people to offer a drink or that again kind of thing. And it used to be my husband would say, "Oh, if somebody at the table was drinking wine and they put a table, he'd be the first one." And no, don't, And they're like, "Oh, come on, I got this. You think I'm all of a sudden gonna pick up a glass of wine?" But I think it's good to be mindful and to be respectful of not putting triggers in front of them, right? But that's again a really fine line. So I would take them aside and say, "How do you feel about David clearing the thing?" He says, "I get it that he's trying to be sweet, but we'd rather not be singled out like, hey, because we've got it. We don't need to do that, and we don't need to anybody else taking care of us on that end of it, because it makes us feel like you don't believe that I'm in charge of it, right?" But I mean, they understand it comes from love, so they're not, making an issue, just kind of rolling their eyes like, yeah, whatever. It's well, life is tough, right? It's just tough. You making a trying to always make the right decisions for you and for your loved ones. It's no simple task.
This is so good. I'm just getting enlightened. You're just giving good stuff.
Thank you.
So yeah, before we wrap up, go ahead and give us some information. Give us a look into what you do with the organization, and if there's anything that a mom can reach out to you for, or if they want to help you, or I don't know how it goes, but let
Yeah.
us look in on what it is that you do.
Thank you. So I'll define this for you. So A New Path started in 1999. We're coming up on 25 years of this. I had no idea. And by the way, people thought that once my sons were in recovery, like, "Why are you still doing this? Why aren't you retiring?" And instead, I'm feeling like, no. And now we can help other people with all this. Yeah. So thank you. And in 2009, I started the Moms United to End the War on Drugs collaborative campaign. And it was because people in other cities and states were saying, "Hey, we need a new path here. How do we do that?" Well, having started A New Path with a lot of passion and by the seat of my pants, and having a no, I was still an active, still am an active fashion show producer. I didn't really know how to, and didn't feel like I had the bandwidth. We tried another chapter in Los Angeles, and we have a small chapter in Florida, but I didn't have the ability to build chapters, right? Always had low budgets because this is addictive illness, not a popular cause, right? So it started Moms United as a collaborative campaign, so I could lift up the work, say that a harm reduction center in New York is doing, but in Arizona they didn't have anything, so they could learn from this other chapter and that kind of thing. So it was all about harm reduction strategies and anti-drug war or drug policy reform kinds of things. So it was also so that an individual who says, "I want to be involved, I want to be active," could have a place to be. So it's all online. We meet once a month, and we create six different campaigns, plus those that we address specifically a year, and we give them the materials, the videos, the press releases, and then they can take it to their locality and just add their name as a representative. It's kind of a loose association, but we do have representatives now in 35 states and partnerships in six countries, so who will do these collaborative campaigns together. And there's nothing binding that says you have to do this campaign or you have to do that, but the materials are there, and you can be part of the planning process on Zoom meetings, on monthly Zoom meetings. So if anybody wants to be a representative of Moms United, they just reach out to me, and My email is Gret, G-R-E-T, at anewpath.org. And say you're interested in being a representative and getting involved. And again, it's not any kind of a life commitment. It's as much as you want to participate, as much advocacy as you want to do. But what's been really good is, back to the first statement, is that like, some states didn't have Good Samaritan laws and some did. So they can kind of, this is how we got ours passed. And, or Florida for a long time had no, you couldn't do syringe exchanges, you know, so they now have a syringe exchange. And so just learning from each other so that we can build this up as not just a country, but it's a global issue. So, we learn so much from partners in Europe who are way ahead of us in terms of harm reduction strategies. And so, so that is, and my husband said, "You're starting another organization. Are you out of your mind?" And I said, "No, it's not another organization. It's an expansion of the mission in a way that's manageable." Yeah,
definitely. And I know you got a lot going on, and your husband thinks you have a lot going on, but I'm just hearing book. With you and your son, your sons, your point of view, and then their point. This is just me, but I don't know if that idea has come for you and your sons, but this would definitely be, if nothing else, a help just to hear what was going on each side. What was going on each side? Has that crossed your table?
Yeah, we've been saying that we need to start a podcast too, because when I've had them, you know, in interviews together, we're like, hey, this is pretty good. I also had engaged my older son, is a survivor of overdose. And so, you know, each year at International Overdose Awareness Day, we put it out there that we can have a conversation on both sides. I was very curious because I knew what my, you know, position was, looking at him in a hospital bed and not knowing if he was going to live or die, not knowing if he did live, if his brain would be active, all that stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And then to hear from his side, is he said he didn't know, he was just partying, and he wakes up and he's got a crying mother over him, right? You know, so it's, but you know, so he makes a statement like, I didn't intentionally do this. I didn't intentionally leave the planet or plan. I just was trying to maintain a high, and all of a sudden,
wow.
You know, so it is very interesting to hear both perspectives, you know, and again, it goes back to what I was saying about they didn't do any of what they did to hurt me or their family. It was, you know, it just became that the drug was what they felt they needed every day to live.
Yeah. I'm going to say this before we wrap up. What you said, that your son said he didn't know, he was just out partying.
Yeah.
We get a lot of moms who are very, very sensitive about the term accidental death, because people who don't understand, they throw it out the window. Oh, your kid did drugs. Your kid did drugs. So it's his fault that he's dead, or, you know, they don't really feel the sympathy. The understanding. It's like, my kid was not trying to overdose.
Yeah. Yeah.
So with you saying that, that just brought that flooding in, that there's really a lot of, you know, people are very like, I don't want to hear it. He's doing drugs.
Yeah, I know. And that's that disdain and the othering. We're also experiencing, and I'm sure your listeners are aware of this, your kid was an addict. In other words, mine Mine used street drugs, right? They didn't have a football injury that brought them into it. They were the ones that experimented, and then and the with friends. The friends walk away, but they're the one in 10 that can't walk away, which I think now the now it's the stats are 1 in 8 because most kids experiment. Yeah. Young adults experiment with drugs, you know? They were the ones that couldn't, and they became the street drug users, right? But now we with fentanyl, you got a lot of parents who say, my kid was not an addict. He just took a pill at a party, or he just bought a Xanax that was had fentanyl online, and so he was murdered. My son was murdered versus your bad kid who deserved to die with, and that's just not helpful. We need to be embracing, no matter what door they walked into to their drug use, we need to embrace them all and make sure that everybody on the planet carries Narcan, because everybody deserves to live. And so why not? And then I want to address one more thing. Sometimes it's not accidental. Sometimes, like I was describing with my son getting out, get kicked out of treatment yet again, and not wanting to go to jail, not wanting to go back to treatment, but just saying, I'm going to go out in a blaze of glory and I won't know. I will just, you know. So there is sometimes intentional overdoses, not accidental, when you've just given up hope. You feel helpless and hopeless. And that's what I'm trying to work against, is that sense that a person can't find, and can't find the support services and systems and the way back and the second chance or third chance or fourth chance, right? That instead we have to be saying, there are all those chances because you're a beautiful human being and you deserve to live your best life, right?
That's good. That's good, because they're, if society is so quick to toss them to the side, just imagine what it's doing to
To
them.
them.
That's good stuff. Well, Gretchen, man, this has been so eye-opening, and definitely an encouragement, because you're showing that this we can win. We can win. Both my boys are still here. Both, yeah, both my boys are fighting and they're advocating. The three of you are doing this wonderful, wonderful thing out here fighting, and definitely changing the laws, or fighting to change the laws. So I'm definitely rooting for you guys, because it's a battle,
Thank you.
just like on my end, it's a battle to get the guns off the streets,
Absolutely. That's another major battle, and well, my God.
So I just applaud you. I just applaud you. You're just doing such a wonderful job for 25 years. For 25 years, not just for your boy. You didn't say, okay, my boys are fine, I'm done.
No.
So we thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Is there anything you want to end with? Anything that encouragement, or anything you want us moms, a takeaway before we wrap up?
It's the called, tolerance and compassion. Lead with tolerance and compassion. And we are coming up to Valentine's Day, and that's when we kick off the True Love, Not Tough Love campaign again. And please look at it and get involved with the and understand the need to debunk a philosophy that really is not working, particularly now during an overdose epidemic that's the size and proportion that we're experiencing now. So, so leave with love and compassion and not othering and
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. You have definitely helped moms all over the globe, just giving us nuggets, just giving us an eye opener of what you're doing and your purpose. And we're just cheering you on. We're just cheering
Thank
you
you,
on.
and I appreciate this opportunity.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's an honor. It's an honor. All
Thank you.
right. So thank you, mamas, for joining us for another episode. Stay tuned. I look forward to speaking to you again. Bye, mamas.